another episode of the Albion Draw here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm Aidy Packham, and we are preparing our bunker in association with AllFootballShirts.com. Yes, that's right, in a week where we didn't think there'd be an awful lot to talk about, the power grab that was Project Big Picture has got everyone in a spin. That was, of course, on top of the whole pay-per-view debate that has seen Sky and BT put a £14.95 price tag on games not already selected for broadcast. Then there was the Aaron Connolly Island debacle that saw him quarantined for sitting too close to a staff member who tested positive for COVID, who then turned out not to have it after all, after being forced to sit out the playoff match with Slovakia, and he returned to the starting lineup on Wednesday. Then we also have a small matter of a trip to Snake Mountain on Sunday for a game that means so much to the fans that are still unable to attend. So, Alan Wares and I need a man who knows his way around the football landscape. I said landscape. It's a man who seems to be absolutely everywhere this week. It's the UK's most prominent football finance expert and owner of a Joy Division tea towel. It's Kieran Maguire. Welcome back, Kieran. Lovely to see you. But also,
thanks for the invite back.
Oh, you're always welcome, mate. Always. But also, we're delighted to have with us the chief executive of the Football Supporters Association. It's Kevin Miles. Welcome to the show, Kevin. Lovely to see you.
It's very nice to be here.
And we're still trying to work out what that shirt is you're wearing.
We'll come back to that, actually.
There is an explanation for the shirt. I would very, very rarely wear a red shirt, and it's an ironically worn Euro 2020 England official UEFA produce for a tournament that never took place. But the reason I'm wearing it is because today is Show Racism and Red Cards Wear Red Day, so I'm showing my support for anti-racist education.
Yeah, I've only been booked now, Kieran. Who's done more interviews this week, you or Arsene Wenger?
I think he's done more high-profile ones, but yeah, it has been quite busy. Talk Sport, BBC News, Five Live, I did half hour there, and I've done 7 or 8 podcasts for different clubs, as well as a lot of local radio. I work in academia, I've got a responsibility to talk to people when they want some form of independent analysis, I guess.
I mean, the obvious place to start here, guys, is obviously with the Project Big Picture, which is we know now has been pretty much shot down in flames. But now, Kieran, as a football finance expert, I mean, you've been talking about this all week. Oh yeah, he's a boffin, a genius.
Yes, yeah.
Many epithets have been put on your
egghead. Head. I think was one of them.
Yeah, egghead. Yeah. That's usually me. I mean, where do we start with this? Because I mean, obviously we look at it from a Brighton centric point of view, and we saw the interview with Paul Barber this week, which saw him visibly animated about the whole thing. I mean, it was a power grab, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've got a copy of it, the full 18, version 18. I've been through every line. There are some good things in it, you know, so let's addressing the fact that there is wealth inequality within the football system in the UK is something which should be explored. But the approach which has been taken, which is to increase the wealth of the elite clubs in the Premier League, which I don't think is good, transfer some money to the clubs in lower leagues, which is good. So yeah, there's a zero-sum game in all aspects of life. So where is the money being squeezed from? It's going to be two clubs are going to lose their place in the Premier League. So that frees up around about £200 million. The elimination of parachute payments. But when you actually look at the small print, they're being replaced by something which looks like parachute payments. And then this promise of 25% of all monies going to the EFL. Now, that looks absolutely fantastic until you go to, again, to the small print. And first of all, Liverpool and Manchester United would be able to sell the rights to 8 of their games internationally. So who are Liverpool going to sell the rights to their games for? Is it going to be against Fulham, Brighton, Palace, Watford and so on? Or is it going to be Manchester United, Spurs, City, Everton, Liverpool, Chelsea, Leeds and so on? So what will happen is that 25% of a much smaller pot will now go to the clubs in the EFL. And also the £250 million, which again is a nice big shiny figure, which has been promoted by the EFL for around about 6 months now. That is not a gift. That is a prepayment of the 25% of the money coming from this shiny new deal, i.e. it's the equivalent of a payday loan. And the owners of many clubs in the lower leagues, they seem to have ignored this. I think the way that it's been sold is it's like a timeshare presentation by the people involved. And I'm concerned that all we're doing is we're kicking a problem down the line. And then the power grab, where effectively John Henry and Joel Glazer, and remember Manchester United is a Cayman Islands listed company, they will be able to decide on how many clubs get promoted and relegated in future years. They'll be able to effectively set the wage cap in the Championship. And the gap between the rich clubs and the poor clubs in the they're not poor clubs, the less wealthy clubs. At present, the biggest club in the Premier League earns around about 4.5 times the amount of the smallest. That gap would grow exponentially.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you look at it, I mean, obviously, you look at, obviously, these are both very high-profile American businessmen. And you look at something like the MSL in America, where there is no promotion and relegation. They're obviously looking at that model and they're thinking that the wealthy clubs get wealthier, and it's like an elite club, for want of a better phrase.
Well, that's the aim. It is the Americanization of English football. To buy a franchise in the MLS is incredibly expensive. So this would actually be the best of both worlds. They will have both managed to have bought the clubs for relatively cheap prices because of the issues that we have in terms of promotion, relegation, because of to a certain extent that the Premier League's been quite democratic in the way that TV monies have been distributed in the past, which means the likes of the Albion can do the double against Arsenal. They can beat Spurs. Palace can go to Old Trafford and win. Jack Grealish can be kept at Aston Villa because the way that the money is distributed allows Aston Villa to pay him a wage which makes it difficult for the other clubs to take him off his hands. And all of these things, for me, are what make the Premier League great. If you love the Premier League, and you know, I know it's not for everybody, but it is competitive. It does have a degree of unpredictability. And there's been an absolutely fantastic article in the Athletic today, which sort of summed up what John Henry and Joel Glazer want, which is more power, more control, and more money. And that's all that this is. They're not out to help the clubs in the EFL.
Kevin, now I know that you've been through the paperwork as well. So I just wanted to bring you in here at this point. Now, you've had the headline stuff from Kieran there. And again, stuff which, you know, certainly the EFL clubs are actually promoting, well, we want this 250 million. We're actually out realizing that the amount of caveats there are here. So with actually, I suspect that Brighton and Newcastle, because obviously you're a Newcastle fan, being in a not dissimilar position in this, plus with your FSA hat on, I was just wondering if I could have a reaction to what Kieran's told you and from what obviously has happened in this last 7 days since the thing was first leaked.
Well, I don't think it'll surprise anybody that I concur entirely with Kieran's analysis of this. I think it's a fairly shameless attempt as well to cash in on short-term absolute desperation by a lot of EFL clubs who, because of the COVID crisis, are facing a real cash flow issue and they are worried about their existence. And this has been timed, I think, to exploit that. It's also, we've described it, I think, as a sugar-coated cyanide pill. Mm-hmm. And the focus of the attention, and certainly Rick Parry's sale of it at the EFL clubs meetings this week, was all about the sugar and not much mention of the cyanide. And the cyanide is, as you know, Kieran's outlined, it's the power grab, it's the handing over control of the whole of English football, effectively, to the big six clubs. And with an eye to the European Super League and opening up opportunities for further and further internationalisation of their participation and of the money in the game as well. And, I mean, they say that they want to address the chasm, as they describe it, between the Championship and the Premier League. But if you actually look at the proposals, all it really effectively does, it moves that chasm up 14 places. And it means that the huge gulf will be become between the big six and everybody else in the Premier League and the Championship.
Kevin, do you think it shows disrespect to the pyramid then?
I think it shows a complete disregard for the pyramid. I think it's all about self-interest. They have been clever in dressing it up as concern for the pyramid. That's one of the sleights of hand that's gone on here with their talk about solidarity and sharing the money. I mean, even that sharing of the money, if you actually look at it, the distribution model that they've got, they're proposing to share money. It'll be a smaller pot, as Kieran has already outlined, but effectively share the money of the bottom 14 in the Premier League with the Championship and with the EFL. If you look at the model that they've very kindly in that paper version 18, which I've also got, you look at it, and they've actually put in there what their model would have meant for last season. And on the basis of last season, prior to last season, Liverpool would have been £14 million, I think it is, better off than they were this season. Whereas once you get down to club number 7 in the league, you are starting to be worse off. And I don't know what it is about Newcastle United. And it just seems to follow me everywhere I go. But if you look at the figures, the club who would be worst off compared to what actually happened last season, will be the club that finished in 13th place. It will be £24 million worse off. Guess who that was?
It's not Newcastle by any chance, was it?
Not that team that recently lost 3-0 to Brighton, was it?
No, the thing is, that's the point, because it's that 0-0 that actually put Newcastle in that horrible place.
The big six are guaranteeing an increase in their share of the income that's generated that way. But, I mean, there's all sorts of flaws in it. I mean, the calculations are based on an assumption of a 10% increase in broadcast revenues. I don't know anybody who's anticipating an increase in broadcast revenues.
They're coming down, if anything.
Everybody thinks that, you know, if you get away with a 10% decrease, you're doing quite well in the current climate. Mm. They go to the market in March for a broadcast deal after an entire year, probably, without a single fan in the ground. If that doesn't impact on the product that they're selling, and obviously financially, the COVID has had its effect on the economy generally, there's no way that income is real. It's fictitious. But then selling the individual matches separately itself undermines the model, because the broadcasters have always been buying exclusive rights to the football. They're going to find themselves in competition, the broadcasters in competition with the very people, the very clubs that they're financing, because they'll be, you know, up against the directly streamed matches that they were proposing to take. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why this is dead in the water in its current form.
Yeah.
And what it has done is it's highlighted some of the problems. And I've been struck in the last week by the number of people who, for the first time, have declared that they would accept or are in favour of independent regulation of football, because it seems to be increasingly clear that football cannot regulate itself.
You're in.
Okay.
Well, I agree absolutely with Kevin. And again, it calls into question, why did the EFL board reject the recommendations of Jonathan Taylor QC's report in January, which suggested having 3 independent directors on the board of the EFL? So is there a conflict of interest taking place? Because remember, that board of the EFL last Friday rejected a £375 million offer for a 20% stake in the EFL from a Texan company. So that values the EFL, you know, at a pretty sizable sum. Now, I think you could probably get a better price for perhaps a lower lower percentage, as we've seen what we've seen happen in Italy, where they sold 10% instead of 20. But for that to be rejected by the EFL board and none of the clubs were told, it does seem that power is being concentrated in very few hands and scrutiny is not being encouraged. In fact, I spoke to a club owner yesterday in the EFL who said, I've got experience of business, but I am kept at arm's length because there is clearly a desire to push through the Glazer Henry.
Kieran, is there a degree of old school tie about this?
I couldn't possibly comment on that. It's not.
Well, the thing is, the other thing I want to ask about this then, Kieran, is that bearing in mind the public Zoom meeting that Paul Barber did, and like as AD said at the top of the show, it was as a visibly annoyed Paul Barber talking about how this had come about, you know, and the way that we were told. Now, he alluded to the fact that it was only the Telegraph had made out that Man United and Liverpool were driving this, and that the following day they were going to have their Premier League meeting to find out what on earth was going on. Now, as it sounds like it's transpired, it's the case that, you know, they're all going to sort of work together, you know, or 20 work together in one room rather than sort of like the sort of smoky backroom stuff going on. But from what you've seen, I mean, I think Paul was trying to be a little bit more diplomatic, but from what you've seen, is it Liverpool and Manchester United driving this, or are there other forces, or who is it that's doing this? Because only Rick Parry's put his head above the parapet, hasn't he?
Well, no, it is Liverpool and Manchester United driving it, with now a lot of support from Stan Kroenke at Arsenal, you know, the three American owners, because their focus is on profitability and bottom line. Manchester City are a bit more of a rogue club because they're more interested in sporting success. Chelsea, through the wealth of Abramovich, are independently wealthy enough to go with whatever they feel is best for them. But this is classic business strategy. You start off with an outrageous position, and then in 4 years' time, when we do, and we are going to have an 18-team Premier League, by the way. You know, I've listened to people at the ECA. The Carabao Cup has always been going to be going. It's just a case of what happens on the back of that. The Big Six clubs will become extremely wealthy from the expanded Champions League. They could take all of that money, but they want more. You know, the level of greed is what is such a shame. I have no issue, and you know, we all know where we are in the football environment. Manchester United and Liverpool are the crown jewels in terms of global football brands, from as far as the Premier League are concerned. They already have far more than the other clubs. They will become even more wealthy as a result of the expanded Champions League and the ICC Cup and things of this nature, but that's not enough. It's just naked greed, and that's so disappointing.
But Kieran, I mean, you mentioned Man City there and their quest for sporting success, but that's one of the reasons why the Premier League is so successful, isn't it? Because we don't have a one dominant side in the division, although we have this top six. You know, any one of those six could actually theoretically, and there still is the romance of Leicester winning the league, and which is aspirational for every other side in the league. I mean, Everton this year got a wonderful start. Whether they can maintain it or not is another story for another day. But you know, these stories happen in this league, which they don't happen in other countries.
Well, but the aim of Project Big Picture is to ensure that the likes of Everton, Newcastle under PIF, Wolves under Fosun, Leicester under their owners, it's to ensure that they don't have the absolute outrageous desire to succeed and challenge those clubs who think that they have a divine right to pick up all of the Champions League places. If you take a look at the Premier League table in that first season, you know, who finished, you know, Manchester United won it. Second, I think, was Aston Villa. Third was Norwich. I think Wimbledon finished above Spurs. You know, and people forget that because it's now become so ingrained in English football culture that the Big Six are there. And then people start to believe that that's always been the case. It's utter nonsense. They've been there for the last 10 years. simply because they've got financial advantages over the others.
Because one of the perverse ironies about this, and again, it's good we've got Kevin on, is that the big six, as they're normally put there, plus three more on account of the fact of Premier League longevity. Someone actually then pointed out, well, actually, Newcastle and Aston Villa have spent more years in the Premier League than Manchester City have. So we've got this ridiculous anathema, Kevin, anyway.
Yeah, there's a lot of question about the formula arriving in it. I mean, I don't think we should underestimate as well. I mean, the competitive balance of the Premier League is distorted already. The last time that they came up with crackpot ideas like this, as Kieran said, it's not an unusual strategy. But part of the approach of the Premier League towards that has been of appeasement. And that's why they gave the bigger clubs a bigger share of the international broadcast revenues in the last time round. So that's now distributed on a less equitable basis so that those big clubs at the top get a bigger share. And it's entrenching in permanency that gulf between the big clubs and the other. But the biggest distorting factor now is the Champions League revenue. If you look at the season before last, West Bromwich Albion finished bottom of the league. And Liverpool, I think, was the second the season before last one.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And the differential between the two clubs and what they got from second of the league to bottom, the differential between the two in terms of the prize money in the Premier League was less than the amount that Liverpool got from their European participation. Mm. So in other words, the European, just the games that they play, just as in what always used to be an extra frills on top of the domestic programme. In terms of money, that's now become the biggest single distorting factor. So if you put in the two things together, regular Champions League participation, which they are pretty much guaranteed, and the extra differential they're getting inside the Premier League for the money, there is no way anybody can break that. And you see that when there was the talk around the European Super League, you could see the attitudes of people like Agnelli at Juventus and others about these. They couldn't understand why. I mean, Agnelli actually said, how can it be right that when I have invested over a quarter of a century so much into building Juventus into a global brand, that I am having to share the spoils of that with Leicester City that I've never heard of? He had the same sort of approach towards Atalanta and in Italy. You know, it's just how dare they, these upstart teams? But that's what the beauty of the English pyramid's always been about.
Okay, before we move on from this, I just want to just quickly, because there is an emergency fund for Leagues 1 and 2, Kieran. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, it's £50 million, I think. It's a £20 million grant and a £30 million loan, which I don't think that the Premier League have helped themselves with there. I think if they'd gone in and negotiated directly with the clubs in League 1 and 2, they could have got them on far more on side than they actually are. Clubs in League 1 and 2, they have to go and pay the wage bill at the end of October. And there is a genuine danger that somebody could go bust if they don't do by the end of November. As far as the Championship is concerned, they weren't included in this. And the reason why is if you take a look at Bournemouth, this year they will get £42 million in parachute payments. They've sold Nathan Ake for £45 million. They've sold Callum Wilson for about another 10 or 12. They've got Eddie Howe off the wage bill. They've got Ryan Fraser off the wage bill. The EFL are now saying, we have to treat Bournemouth equally to all the other clubs. No, you don't, because they don't need it. Oh, they're also owned by a company in the British Virgin Islands, controlled by a Russian oligarch. Are they the same in terms of necessity as Luton Town, who are owned by Gary Sweet, who's a lifelong Luton fan, who operate on a wage bill which is a fraction? And also, if you take a look at Bournemouth, and this isn't anti-Bournemouth, you know, I think they did extremely well, A, to get promoted through playing good football, and B, playing good football in the Premier League. They made £3.80 out of every 100 from matchday income. So that's what they've lost. They've lost £3.80 out of every 100.
Okay, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. Over 110,000 shirts of various different colours and shades and shapes and sizes for your delectation. Phil has sent us over one for this week's shirt of the week, which Kevin is going to describe for me now.
Well, it's very red.
It is, which is red is very good.
Red, and it's got white trim. And I presume there's no difficulties here in mentioning the manufacturer's name.
No, we're not the BBC, mate. Don't worry. Carry on.
Blazoned just below the V of the neck is the Adidas logo in white.
Yep.
And then it's got writing on.
Yes. And do you want to hazard a guess to where the shirt's from? Or a year?
Well, the year isn't quite so difficult, given that it's actually written on the front of the shirt. So, I'll hazard a guess at 2010.
You would be right. To 2011.
We've got another Wrexham moment. So it says on the front of the shirt, it says, I think it's Rovaniemi or Rovaniemi UNICEF City. Kieran, do you recognise the badge at all? It looks like Santa Claus on the badge.
Well, it looks like Santa Claus. Could it be, given that it's red and white and Santa, are we talking Lapland?
You're not far off, actually. I'm going to tell you what it is, because we've got an awful lot of stuff to get through. This is what your shirt of the week. This is one of the most recent additions to my collection, said Phil. This is the 2010 to 2011 home shirt of Finnish side Santa Claus FC. Yes, there really is a team called that. And they play in the Nelunen or E-Divisionuna, which is the fifth level of football in Finland. The side was formed in 1993 as an amalgamation of two sides, Ruthermen Raipas and Ruthermen Lahti. And they retained the status in the Kapernan League, which is the Finnish third level. And over the years, they've yo-yoed between levels three and four until last season when they were relegated to the fifth level. They play at the Ruthermen Keskiluta stadium, which has a capacity of 5,000 and is used for not only football, but for cross-country skiing in the snowier months. Their only real honour so far was winning the 1994 Midnight Skupen, which is the Midnight Sun Cup, and former players include Toma Czekanecki, a Canadian Israeli goalkeeper who played much of his career in North America. There was Mika Mati Mezenlevada.
You're making this up now, aren't you, AD?
Who made 22 appearances as a left back in 2011. And Simo Raiha, who had three stints with FC Santa Claus, making over 50 appearances and scoring 15 goals. I can't find too many links to past players in the UK, although I do know that Bruno failed in an interview recently to become their new manager, but he was told to come back when his beard gone. Thanks for that, Phil.
I love it when you try and speak Finnish, AD. It's another thing entirely. It was a joy. Thank you for that.
It was a thing, beauty. Yeah. Unlike the thing that happened to the Republic of Ireland this week, Kieran, and with our very own Aaron Connolly, who was sitting. I've got the actual stats here. He was sitting 10 centimeters too close to a staff member, apparently.
Well, I think it was a member of the backroom staff at Ireland. They had to have regular testing, as we're all aware. Tested positive. Everybody within 1.5 meters or just 1.8 meters had to be therefore quarantined. So therefore, Aaron was quarantined. It then subsequently turned out that the positive test was a false positive. But by then, Aaron had missed the Slovakia game, to which
he was due to start.
It was due to start, and the Republic and Ireland nil, as they are now commonly referred to, unfortunately, under the present regime, lost the match on penalties, and they're not going to the... They've lost their opportunity to go to the Euro 2020 finals next year, which is an absolute bummer for me, because I've got tickets for Dublin, and I've rolled them over from this year. Well, you know, it's fine. I've still got a weekend in Dublin. COVID, assuming that we've made progress, and there's no guarantee there. But it's a shame for Aaron, and it's a shame for the Republic. But I think it does go to show that the health issues are still, we are still far from where anybody wants to be in A, the testing, and clearly B, we're still miles away in terms of progressing with this cursed disease.
He's available for Sunday, isn't he?
Yeah, I should put it. I mean, he did actually start for them on Wednesday night.
On Wednesday.
So I mean, it was just crazy that the fact that he was actually sat in the wrong seat on the plane apparently, and if he was sat where he was meant to be sitting, he'd have been all right. But it was him and Adam Idar as well, who was in the same boat, and it's terrible because I mean, you know, if he was still on the pitch, he would have taken one of those penalties. And we all know our confidence levels with our current penalty paper, Mr. Morpai, although he seems to be very confident.
Actually, can I just say a couple of things there, AD? One, there's a couple of things we learned about Aaron Connolly. I can't remember who it was from. It was a Vox Pop that the club did. Is that one, in training, Connolly is the easiest person to nutmeg. And secondly, he's also the one who is most likely to look in a mirror when he walks past it. He is apparently quite the tart.
Okay, well, let's move on to the other big story this week, which is, of course, the pay-per-view things. I mean, the story has taken many guises over the week, with fans first in uproar, firstly about the concept, and then the pricing. And then it emerged that Leicester were the only club to vote against it. And next was the fact that if it didn't go to pay-per-view, then games wouldn't be shown. And clubs, well, Paul Barber, was saying that it wasn't the clubs that set the price. Now, BT and Sky have come out and suggested that it was the Premier League who set the price. Kieran, what is going on?
Well, there's a lot of whataboutery and finger-pointing, as you'd expect in the politics of modern-day football. The decision to go to pay-per-view, I think this is actually, again, a bit of opportunism that pay-per-view is going to be as part of football at some point in time. I'm not in favour of it. I suspect Kevin's not in favour of it as well. But it's then a case of trying to work out what is the most successful price point. So you normally start in by going in high and reducing price rather than the other way around. $14.95 for me is excessive. Listening to Paul Barber at sort of the town hall meeting, he seemed to say that there were many other clubs that felt that the price as a tenner, looking at it from a finance point of view, I've heard the stuff from BT and Sky to say, oh, it's cost us extra money to broadcast. It will cost them nothing extra because the cameras are already there for Match of the Day. The cameras are already there for the overseas TV deals, many of whom stream matches live. So, you know, that was a complete nonsense. And, you know, getting a local commentator to do the commentary is not worth an extra fiver for 90 minutes. So the price was too high. I think the consequences are that if you are a Burnley fan and you now face three of your games being on pay-per-view, what are you going to do? We've all got a mate called Big Dave. In fact, you probably know. Certainly here, we've had Big Dave in the studio.
We've had him on the show.
One who got lost in Newcastle.
Big Dave knows somebody who can get you hold of a fire stick. So it's unfair against those clubs such as Burnley and West Brom, who now have three pay-per-view matches. It's unfair of fans of clubs such as Newcastle. I was on Radio Newcastle at 7 o'clock this morning. When Mike Ashley's not prepared to refund them any money. At least the Albion, I think, have done the right thing. They're accelerating the money back to fans, and then they're saying, it's up to you what you choose to do with it.
I mean, Kevin, along those lines, I mean, obviously I've been part of the Premier League, sort of some of the Premier League fans meetings and party to what the FSA have been talking about with the Premier League. Now, I appreciate that the Premier League come back to us and say it's up to clubs to set their own individual ticketing policies, but Newcastle, I've got to, you know, let's talk about Newcastle because you've got quite a few issues up there with regards to actually getting access to your club to talk about refunds, haven't you?
Yeah, that's you have a rare talent for understatement there, Al, to be honest.
this has never been said before ever by anybody.
It's the it's very difficult to get a clear position out of Newcastle about anything. So we're never quite sure how furious we should be because we don't know what the policy is. But the fact of the matter is, they haven't refunded. They are people who paid for their season tickets. I've got a huge personal investment in Newcastle United at the moment because I've paid for all four of my family season tickets for the entire season back in March in the second week of the first lockdown. They took all of my direct debits for the entire season. They are still taking month by month direct debit payments from people for this season, despite the fact that they know it's unlikely that anybody's going to get to see any of those matches potentially until March. It seems to be what they've been saying is possibly the earliest time. So, I mean, it's outrageous, really. I mean, it doesn't make the 1495 any better. But one of the things that the Premier League had said was that they wanted to uncouple the season ticket refunds from the pay-per-view prices, because there was a lot of muddied waters with clubs saying, we'll give you a discount code, but in that it sort of undermines your entitlement to your refund, etc., and all that sort of thing. So they've uncoupled the two. Everybody should be getting a full refund for every match that they're not going to see. Ultimately, that's a legal entitlement. If you pay for a product that you don't get, you're entitled to your money back. The 1495, I think, is outrageous. I mean, the genesis of this, you remember, we go back a stage, we actually had to have a campaign to get the matches on television at all, because they agreed to put all the matches behind closed doors last season on telly. But when we started this season behind closed doors, they had to be forced to put those onto the TV. And then when they thought we were going to get fans back, you know, it was from the 3rd of October, there was a big question mark about they didn't want to put the matches then back on television. Now, we have, every club in the Premier League has, fans who have not missed a game for decades.
Yeah.
And yet, because of those decades, they may well have pushed themselves through virtue of their age into a category where they're having to shield themselves against COVID or whatever else. So with the best will in the world, they can't, for health reasons, go to the matches. We didn't want a situation where people like that, season ticket holders, couldn't see their matches. So we had to fight to get the matches on in the first place. But this 1495, I mean, there is a lot of book passing going on about whose responsibility it is. Technically, the Premier League are very nervous about this because it is actually illegal for the Premier League to be involved in the price setting under the Ofcom regulations.
As stated by Paul Barber, yes.
Mm. Yeah. But it's a bit more complex than that, because what happens is, obviously, the broadcasters come up with a package and say, this is what it's going to cost us to put them on. That's what we have to cover. How much do you want for your clubs out of that as well? They put the two things together to come up with a cost. And then the broadcasters go away and work out what price they have to do to, you know, have to charge in order to generate that amount of money to cover their costs. Now, the problem we've got, I think they've got, is that what they've completely miscalculated and setting at that level is the number of people who won't buy it.
Yeah.
And I'm a Newcastle fan, as you've hinted at. the first of those matches takes place on Saturday. It's Newcastle at home to Manchester United. And I'm not paying $14.95 to watch that. If you think about it, it'll be on live on television. It's at 8 o'clock in the evening kickoff. Within half an hour of the match finish, it'll be on Match of the Day. I'll listen to it on the radio and watch the highlights, and that's going to have to do me. Now, I don't miss Newcastle matches lightly. I do home and away normally in normal circumstances, but it's a bridge too far for me. And I think they've made a huge issue out of the whole situation. I think pay-per-view wouldn't be a problem if they'd priced it sensibly. Yeah. If they'd said it was going to be a fiver, seven, even up to a tenner, which is the iFollow price in the Football League, they probably wouldn't have got the storm that's surrounded this. But there's no way back from that now.
But so, all of this is good news for people who want to go and watch a local football. I mean, the amount of people say, right, this is it, this is the straw that's broken the camel's back. And I'm going to go and watch my local side as well. I know, Kieran, you've been having a tour of Sussex non-league grounds recently. I mean, how's that been for you?
I absolutely loved it. It's rekindled my affection for the game. The first match I went to, I think, was at Hassocks. And the quality of football was actually quite good. It's very fast. You know, the ball's in the air. To a certain extent, but it, you know, we were all of a certain age, and there was quite a few elements of old school football, such as when the centre half got a red card and then walked off into the opposition dugout, offering to take out any of them in the car park following the match. This is the game I fell in love with, you know. So it was, and you're there 10 yards away, just listening to this, and it's, you go, this is just fantastic nonsense.
Yeah. I've been going to the Phoenix Southwick club that Attila the stockbroker's been heavily involved in, and I had exactly the same issue. Someone went through the centre half, went through the winger, knocked him, you know, into the middle of next week, red card, couldn't understand it. wanted to have a fight with everyone, from the opposition to the dugout, to the trees, to the corner flag, everyone. You could just see the red mist. It was just this sort of ready brick glow of...
It's like that word that manager we watched. I can't remember what team Worthing were playing, but the manager who completely self-combusted.
The thing is, what we've got anyway is that when the Albion aren't at home, then we can do, you know, the non-league thing. And I think that non-league football, actually, possibly just because of the irie that people have with the aim at the top of the pyramid, is that we are getting to go and see our local sides. And I say, you and I, AD, we both live in Worthing. And it's fabulous going to see them. It's Tier 7 stuff. There's some good stuff there. I mean, I assume, when Newcastle aren't at home and you don't go to follow them away, but even now during lockdown, are you actually going to see your sort of local clubs near to where you are?
I'm actually a season ticket holder at Blyth Spartans as well as at Newcastle. I mean, unfortunately, I can't go to see them because they're the National League North and they're not allowed crowds at all. But I have been able to go and see North Shields and others in the area. I have to say, by the way, I'm a long-standing fan of non-league football. I'm delighted that more and more people are going to see it, but I'm a little bit appalled that you sophisticated gentlemen in the genteel South Coast Resort are taking such vicarious pleasure in the menace and violence that Blight's taking.
It's the only way we get our savage feelings met. It's the only way. Apart from that, then it's back to the tea and scones.
But is this a nice segue into our next topic, which is repopulating the stadiums. Now, as you said there, Kevin, I mean, Blyth aren't allowed people in
yet. Can I just ask, though, across you, what level are Blyth Spartans at? What tier level are they at?
National League North.
So that's Tier 6, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, so is it no one's in at Tier 6? Because Worthing are Tier 7. Are allowing people in, aren't they?
Yeah,
right.
Below the National League.
That's the cut-off.
Okay, got you. Yeah. Okay, Karen, sorry, AD.
So, the situation is, I mean, as Kieran knows, he's been going on his guided tour of non-league Sussex grounds. I was going to do a quiz, but we'll do that another time. But it was, it's frustrating because, I mean, Kevin, I mean, you probably didn't see Paul Barber's Q&A this week, but, I mean, he went into great detail about the fact that we had our game, pre-season friendly game at the Amex against Chelsea. 2,500 fans were allowed in. He had government officials alongside him, and they reported back to the government about what they saw. There was a meeting a week or so afterwards where they discussed it and all their findings.
The brakes were slammed on after what they thought was actually a very positive day.
Yeah, I mean, where do we go from here?
Well, I mean, I can offer a bit of insight to this because I've been involved in, you know, the safety committee, which operates under the Sports Ground Safety Authority, and all of the feedback on the test events was extremely positive. I mean, people were struck by how good football clubs were at getting the measures in place, how rigorous and careful they were. I mean, nobody's blasé about the health risks here. That's obviously health considerations come first, but there are very few organisations with as much experience of marshalling crowds and moving people about as football clubs. There are very few groups of the population as compliant in groups as football fans are, and they used to be spread around. And all the anecdotal and data results from the test events, the one at Brighton against Chelsea you've mentioned, but there were a series of others run in the EFL, I think it was 10 the weekend before the decision was announced. It was all really positive. We did a survey of people who've been involved in those, and we found, and get this for a statistic, 88% of fans said that they trusted their football club to guarantee their safety in a football match under the COVID regulation.
Wow.
When did you last get 88% of football fans trusting their football club
with anything?
And I do know that the Department of Culture, Media and Sport were all ready to allow the go-ahead for the return of fans, albeit with a reduced percentages. We're looking at 20, maximum 30% of fans. But beginning of that process, and there were people in the DCMS who had been intimately involved in this. The first they found out that it wasn't going to happen was when Michael Gove played on Radio 4 to announce that we had to be ready for, you know, 6 months of tightening up, and it wasn't going to happen. And I mean, I've been party to some bizarre conversations. You have a conversation with health authorities, and they say they accept that what's happening at a football ground is safe. What they're worried about is people gathering in the pubs and breaching the, you know, guidelines in the pubs beforehand. But then the conclusion that they draw is to ban the football match from going ahead, but leave the pubs open. Why they couldn't just close the pubs for 5 hours around the match or something, and you know, let the, you know, the event go ahead. And it's an existential threat to a lot of clubs at that level. Government are going to have to step in and support them. I mean, as an aside to what we were discussing before, I don't want to let the government off the hook about helping League One and League Two clubs. I don't think it's fair that they should be left with a begging bowl to the Premier League. There's no other section of the economy where the government is saying the wealthy firms have to help out the poor ones. Costa Coffee is not being asked to help out the Greasy Spoon. You know, the Bronze franchise isn't being asked to help local theatres. So why should the Premier League clubs be, let's put it the other way around, why should League One and League Two clubs be dependent on what the Premier League is prepared to give them with whatever conditions they might want to attach to it?
Yeah.
The government should be stepping in, sorting them out as well.
Kieran, I mean, I've got to say that, you know, during this Q&A that Paul Barber was doing, and Paul Camelin, the club's press officer, asked him a direct question. Clearly a leading one, but a direct question. Is this down to the fact that he feels that the government or the DCMS specifically don't trust football fans? And Barber was saying, well, I don't think they do. I mean, I'm just... Obviously, you're talking to people at a high up at that level. Are you getting the same vibe?
No, I mean, I've spoken to one or two people at DCMS, the same as Kevin, and I think some of them definitely do get football and understand, and others have a somewhat old world view. But the decision was taken out of their hands. It's as simple as that. I'm entirely in alignment with Kevin. We now have this ridiculous situation, and I've seen the letter which has been sent out by the EFL to its member clubs, showing the protocols that are now required for EFL clubs can now broadcast their own match in their own hospitality lounge with the shutters put around the windows. In an inside environment where we know that COVID-19 is a greater chance of being transmitted, but they cannot watch it the other side of the window, which again we know has a far reduced. So there is no logic in the decisions which are being made.
Well, I think Paul Barber was offering that up, and I think that's almost a level of trolling, isn't it? Trolling the government, saying, look, you know, during a game we're going to open up the 1901 hospitality. But just make sure the curtains are closed.
Yeah,
and we're going to watch it outside. We've now got drive-in football in the car park outside a football ground where you can have four people sitting in a car, and the chances are you might go with your neighbours because you all want to go in the same car together.
Yeah,
you've got clubs at certain points in the pyramid where you might be getting an average crowd of 100 or 150. And if you imagine how much space there is around the perimeter of a match in terms of how much scope there is for social distancing, mm-hmm. in there, and that there are some local authorities who are policing this so tightly that they are not allowed to sell beer to somebody to go and take and a plastic glass and stand on a terrace 20 yards away from the next nearest person, because the regulations insist that you can only serve beer if it's delivered to a table.
We're going to get a bit of radio silence here, because you just got to take it in, haven't you? And you scratch your head, and believe me, scratching your head doesn't sound good on the radio. But it's almost as if they, of course they're not, but it sounds like they're deliberately picking on us. I mean, I always go back in the summer when Boris Johnson arbitrarily said cricket isn't going to start up because people touching the ball. Football could start, but cricket can't. And the first cricket knew about it, the first DCMS knew about it, was this announcement. I mean, words fail me. I mean, I didn't realise this, but Kieran, you're apparently off to. Are you actually off to Westminster? Or are you doing? Are you talking to?
No, it's on Zoom.
So, what is it you're actually up to this week?
I've been asked to speak. I presume with regards to the state of finances, and to do an analysis. I'm going to be speaking to one of Kevin's colleagues on Monday, with a view to, I guess, doing a summation of the financial situation. The cost to individual leagues, the cost to individual clubs, and the alternatives that are potentially available, which is good. I mean, 2 days ago, I gave a presentation to the Dutch FA on exactly this topic, You know, our football authorities have got, you know, they're doing their own thing as well. So it is something which is not just affecting the UK, because Dutch football did come back to audiences and they've now been banned. But in Germany, what was it, 11,500 at some matches last weekend. So it isn't that an indictment? And as you know, I'm not party political. Isn't that an indictment of the failure of what we've set out to achieve in this country?
Right, it just leads us nicely on to the next thing, Kieran, because we know that football without fans is nothing, right? And nothing stokes the fires more than a derby day. But I mean, for us, you know, we're not unable to go to Selhurst, which is nice. We won't be kettled. But Kieran, I mean, how do you feel about Sunday? Are you excited about it?
Yeah, the build-up to a derby is full of, you know, expectation and excitement. Have you reached those fever pitch levels yet, Kieran?
No, I mean, I guess like everybody I talk to, and I suspect this does apply to Kevin as well, I hate derby days because you go, if fear of losing is the thing which envelops me pre the match. You know, and unless we are 3-0 up, if we're 2-0 up, I think we're going to lose 3-2. It's a horrible experience, but it's still so addictive. And it goes back to why is football so amazingly special. It's that sense of community. It's that sense of shared memories that you have. My first Palace away game was, I think, 1981, when John Gregory scored twice in the first 15 minutes and we won 3-0 at Selhurst, and we just went back and the party that night in Brighton was absolutely wild. So, you know, I like everybody, it's that those unique memories, that sense of, you know, the night of shame at the Amex in the playoffs. But it's incredibly addictive. Yeah, I'm petrified that we're going to lose. It's the one match in the season you don't want to lose.
Kieran, I know you've already taken precautions similar to that of a night in Russia, by the sounds of it, where you've made sure you've recorded your particular own podcast, Price of Football. If you haven't listened to it, you should. It's amazing. But which you do with a Palace fan, Kevin Day, from a rival pod, 5-Year Plan, who we know, and we know those guys. They're great guys.
Give us a praise of your co-host then, Kieran.
Well, I mean, this was just a weird thing. I decided, and my wife decided, we started to move down back to Sussex 12 months ago, mainly driven through the fact that I love Brighton Hove Albion so much. And it was, with the changing kickoffs times in the Premier League, getting home back to the northwest, yeah, when you're kicking off at 4 o'clock on a Sunday, was just proving to be increasingly problematic. So now I've got this sort of weird life where I commute to Liverpool to go to work, but it means that I'm closer to my football club, and that doesn't make me a super fan or anything of that nature. You all three of you inherently understand the logic behind what I've done. I'd been approached about doing this show, and the guy that wanted to put it on suggested that we get Justin Morehouse to be the co-host. I knew I was going to be moving down south, so I didn't think that was going to work. I approached Kevin on Twitter. I genuinely thought that the show would last about 3 weeks, be listened to by two men and a dog. We'd run out of material very, very quickly, and we'd just pretend that it had never happened. You know, one of those sort of blind dates type of things. So I didn't actually tell Kevin that I supported the Albion. But the reason why I was really keen to try to get Kevin on board was that I remember back in 1997, Kevin doing benefit gigs for us when we were desperate. And as I've got to know him over the course of the 12 months, we go back to talking about Palace fans. 99% of Palace fans that I know are great human beings because they support the club for exactly the same reason that Kevin supports Newcastle. And we all support the Albion. It's that sort of that birthright of growing up.
Kieran,
in certain places.
I mean, listening to your show as I do, Kevin isn't slow in getting in anti-Albion barbs, and you're just incredibly well restrained in and not retaliating.
What are you saying here, AD?
I'm saying that Kieran's got the he holds the higher ground.
It's not that. Kevin's a professional stand-up comedian, and I'm a bloke that teaches accounting for a living. You know, he is gonna be the funny Bart guy. You know, I'm the straight man in the pairing. So it's no point me trying to be funny.
I disagree. Anyone who heard your message about a particular sponsor you got for the show this week will
well, and again, sort of, I never thought that at the age of 58 I would be shaving my testicles for money.
Kevin, sorry, we're getting close to the end of the show now, and thank you very much indeed for coming on and being the Newcastle fan and an Albion-centric show. But you are the chief executive of the Football Supporters Association, so here's your platform. Tell us, A, what the FSA is, what you do, and how anyone can get involved should they wish to do so.
Well, it's a membership-based organisation for football fans, and anybody can join. So all you got to do is go to the website, thefsa.org.uk, and join up, and it's free, which compared to pay-per-view prices is a bargain. And to be honest, we are whatever our members want us to be. So we represent the interests of football fans on whatever issues they want us to take up. So we've campaigned on anything from ticket prices, kickoff times, not always successfully, I hasten to add, but we do keep the pressure on, and around big issues like the governance of football, how it's organised and how it's regulated, down to the more micro issues of customer service, of how people are treated by stewards and police and all that sort of thing. So basically all the issues that ever confront football fans at any level of the pyramid, that's our bread and butter, and that's what we have to take up.
And as chief executive, what's your role in all this?
Well, we have a staff team of 16, and I head that up. I'm sort of conduct that particular orchestra of maestros as they do their work in the various different areas, whether it's the network managers who look after the fan groups in all the various different divisions, or the case work that we do, or take your customer relations complaints or issues with policing and stewarding, whether it's the Fans for Diversity campaign that we have a couple of staff working on with contracted with Kick It Out, promoting inclusion and anti-discrimination work in football, right across the piece, tackling issues around lobbying government and liaising with the football authorities, all of that sort of thing.
Brilliant.
Okay, unfortunately, that is actually all we've got time for this week. So thank you very much to Kevin Miles, to Kieran Maguire, to Alan Wares. I've been Eddie Packham, and this has been the Albion Roar. We'll be back next week.